Welcome back to the Leading with Joy podcast. And as we close our series dedicated to joy and hope, today's guest brings a touch of both to everything he does. He's not only an accomplished author, musician, and innovator, but a true maestro of the arts who inspires us to find joy in creativity. With nearly 200 songs, 5 albums, performances alongside greats like John Mayer, Jennifer Nettles, and Gillian Welch, and several novels to his name, his creativity simply knows no bounds. His work resonates deeply with me, as I'm sure it will with you too after this conversation, lifting spirits and challenging us to explore our own potential. Ben Wakeman, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Leading with Joy.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be here.
Ben, you're a visionary whose artistic expression can reawaken parts of ourselves we thought were long forgotten. That's certainly been the case for me. You've been an ongoing source of inspiration since our time working together. And especially over the past couple of years, witnessing your artistic expression has ignited a sense of freedom and flow within me, which I want to share with our listeners and viewers today. And although I may not have mentioned this before, your mastery in storytelling served as the impetus for creating this very podcast platform to share my own narrative. And you may also recall, I turned to you for advice on my very first podcast mic. You truly embody joy and hope, Ben. So let's dive deep right at the start. What does joy mean to you personally? And could you share with us how this feeling inspires your creative process and how you've cultivated it throughout your career?
I think as you get older, joy can be more challenging, for sure. I think that I got more and more serious as I got older and had more responsibility. And I think joy was harder to come by, you know. I think this experience of there's a new little person in my life right now. I've got a 5-year-old daughter my partner has that I get to see every day. And it's a strong reminder that we're born with a huge capacity for joy, that it is our natural state. So for me, that's been a huge part of it. My kids, my grown kids, and also this new child, Bella, are reminders that, you know, joy is something that is always there, that we have to just be able to clear all the rest of the crap away to be able to tap back into.
We certainly share the same vibe. I like how you see joy being our natural state.
Again, I think it. Children are, in most circumstances, you know, unless they're born into abject poverty or real suffering, our natural state is joy. One of the first things a child learns how to do is smile, right? When they're held, they laugh and they smile. That's a developmental mark as humans.
Yeah, that abundance of joy in a smile, right?
Right, right. If the basic needs are met, joy is just there. It just exists. There's no other expectation. I think as we grow older, we have so many more expectations and so much more criteria for what makes us happy. I think that as an adult, it is a journey to get back there in many cases, because the world is a tough place. It is a tough place to survive and to take care of yourself and to take care of the ones that you love. And that can leach away that capacity for joy, I think. So you do have to find ways to pursue it in a way that you didn't when you were a child.
And reflecting on that idea of joy as our natural state, do you remember a time during your teenage years when that sense of joy you felt as a child began to wane and life seemed a bit more cloudy? What was happening in your life at the time, and how did it shape your journey to finding joy?
That's a good question. I haven't thought so much about my teenage years in a long time, but if I reflect quickly on it, I think it's probably when you become self-conscious, right? When you become aware of how others see you, because most children, you know, don't have any awareness of that. They do what comes to them instinctually. However weird or quirky or funny or serious, their nature is who they are. But then as you get to be a teenager and you begin to think about, you know, how you're going to make it in the world, how you're going to secure the love of someone else. You start thinking about the way that you present to the world. And so I think that's probably the natural tipping point for most of us. It certainly was for me. I think I became more aware of how I looked, how I spoke, the things I couldn't say that would change others' perception of me.
And reflecting back on those cloudier days, would you say it was fear, a lack of courage, or just the sheer inexperience of life that overshadowed your joy? It seems particularly relevant today in 2024, as many teenagers struggle to connect with joy. They often feel lost, continuously searching for an identity that seems elusive. What's your perspective on that?
I'm not sure I know the distinction or the difference between lack of courage or fear. I think to me, it's a tough question to answer. Looking back, I haven't really thought about being a teenager in a long time. I think it's probably fear of just being outcast, right? Fear of being rejected by the world, wanting to belong. I think no matter how self-reliant you are as a person or how contrary you are as a person, we have a deep need to belong, to be accepted by a tribe, whatever that tribe is, and it can change throughout your life. But teenagers in particular are keenly aware of that social need, you know, that need to belong. You know, if you're an introvert, it could be just with one or two people, right? But it has to be there. There's something, you know, we're not meant to be solitary creatures. We survive in collective groups. That's just, I think, our nature.
So let's continue with this thought in the context of your novel, The Memory of My Shadow. The story captivates with a protagonist who faces a traumatic event as a teenager, an event that shapes her entire adulthood. And this narrative is profoundly compelling. I'm curious, were there personal experiences from your teenage years that steeped into this narrative? Mm-hmm. Are there any struggles from that time in your life that left such a mark on you that you felt compelled to weave them into your protagonist's journey?
Yeah. Fiction, the reason I love it is it gives us an opportunity to dramatize something on a larger stage that could be much more subtle. For listeners who aren't familiar, this story is sort of a near future science fiction, speculative fiction kind of a piece. And the central character, Magdalena, witnesses the most deadly school shooting in American history. I forget how many people I said. I think it was 48 children are killed in that shooting, which is not an astounding number given how many are shot all the time. So it is a near future kind of a thing. So she and her twin brother is the actual shooter in this. And that event, that catastrophic event, he kills himself after that happens. And the rest of her life is spent on this mission to try and figure out why that happened, right? And this is sort of where technology and AI comes into the mix, because she's really curious about computers and technology and artificial intelligence in particular. And she wants to really understand the human brain kind of by building a model of consciousness to understand, you know, maybe a computer won't break like humans do and do such atrocious things. So that's just a little backstory about the story. There's a lot more to it, but I had an opportunity when I explored this character to walk through memories of being a teenager and that awkwardness and that fear, again, amplified in her circumstances. But I think every character I make has to be infused with some of my own experience and my own heart. Even the ones who are unsavory, even the villainous type characters, there has to be some piece of me in there, the shadow side of me in there. Because I think that's when you read some story and it resonates with you. You think that experience is only private to you. And you're like, when you read it and someone is vulnerable in the page, even in a fictional setting, you're like, oh, and you feel less alone. That to me is power.
Is that what makes good storytelling? In your view, what elements make someone connect deeply with another's narrative? How do you craft your stories to bridge that personal experience with universal appeal?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it's a little different for everyone, but honestly, I think it's conflict. I think a good story can't really exist without hardship of some kind, without some kind of inflection point, some kind of what feels like an insurmountable obstacle. And again, you can dramatize that in a lot of ways. You can make it on a really big stage, you know, like action movie level drama. You can make much more subtle drama that I think the world doesn't have as much of an appetite for, unfortunately. The subtler, you know, more realistic drama, I think, which is a shame because I think it's a lot more relatable. I think many more people can relate to the tragedy that happens in a simple divorce, right? Or a breakup or something that is highly relatable than Jack Reacher, you know, hanging from a helicopter, you know, trying to save the world. Conflict is in both situations. And I, as a storyteller, when you're reading, I think in particular, reading is a very intimate experience. Something happens with the language in our brain. And it really is it's an alchemy that happens, honestly, that we translate words on a page into visuals in our brain. And those visuals become feelings that we internalize, that we take with us. So to me, there is nothing more intimate than reading and also writing. Because when I'm writing, I'm thinking about a reader and how they're going to absorb this and how they're going to feel. What I'm trying to get to is, at the end of the day, it's vulnerability. When a writer is vulnerable, when they share something that feels very private. In fiction, you can dramatize it within a character that looks nothing like you, sounds nothing like you, but had an experience or even a feeling that you describe that is authentically you. And I can pretty much look at every story that I've written and every character. And I, at some point, there's an intersection of, yeah, that's me. I drew that from this particular moment in my life. And they're not big ones. They don't have to be, you know, again, I didn't witness a school shooting, but, you know, I went to a public school, you know, there were shelter in place kind of things that happen. I live in America. I have that fear walking into whenever I drop my daughter off for school, you know, I think about my two grown kids walking through the world in America, and gun violence is an epidemic here. So I write from a very real place in that particular story.
And we'll include a link to your site in our episode description where listeners can pick up a copy of The Memory of My Shadow published on Substack. This platform certainly offers a unique and engaging way for writers to connect directly with our readers. But in reflecting on that and all the new avenues for reaching audiences, where do you see technology bridging gaps that existed before in the world of storytelling?
It's a new world and it's changing all the time. Technology is enabling so many things that didn't exist before. You know, we have had so many inflection points, and having worked as a technologist, you know, for my day job for really most of my adult life, I follow it really closely. About, was it 12, 13 years ago, I published my first novel called Rewind Playback. And it was my first venture into writing fiction. And it was largely, as I look back on it, pretty autobiographical. It was a lot about music, and music is another huge part of my life, playing in bands. So I did that in the traditional way. I self-published it on Amazon, to no great fanfare. You know, a handful of people within my circle and extended circle found it, but it is a sea of options out there, as you know. And if unless you have a big engine, marketing engine with money promoting something, it's never going to go anywhere. So I hunkered down and wrote a lot in the last decade. I've written two complete novels, and this new one that I'm working on called Harmony House is in flight. Yeah, but these two stories, Harmony House and the one you've mentioned, The Memory of My Shadow, are both released on the Substack platform. And Substack is, it's kind of funny. It's like a newsletter posting thing where you create essentially a web page article post and you send it out. It goes to someone's inbox and then, but they collect as an archive on your site. My site is catchandrelease.net. And I'm publishing these as a serial, mostly as an alternative means to be able to get directly to my audience in a more immediate way. I never intended to do these as serials, but they've just evolved in that way. And it's been pretty wonderful because it's a chance for people to slow read, honestly. Now, The Memory of My Shadow is completely published now, so you can go and you can read or listen to the entire story. But if you pick up Harmony House, which is the new one, I'm at episode 12 right now. So it's kind of a chapter by chapter unfolding of the story. And I provide audio narration and original music for all of them. And people have really enjoyed, the audio piece of it because our lives are busy. I can't read as much as I'd like to. I can't sit down in front of a page because it requires 100% of your attention to read. Whereas if you're working out or if you're walking or commuting, it's much easier to listen to something. So it's a great option for people to have that audio book ability. And given my background in music and performance and technology, it's been a joy to bring all those together, to bring the characters to life as I narrate the audio.
Your thoughts on the role of AI in writing are particularly intriguing. With the rise of AI tools, how do you think writers should approach AI enablement? What do you see as the potential benefits? Anything, you know, to be cautious about?
It is a force. No one had any idea how much of a force. Even when I started writing the novel, The Memory of My Shadow, a little over 4 or 5 years ago, I guess it's 4.5 years ago, AI is central to it. And my prediction in the novel is that that artificial intelligence or the singularity, meaning a sentient system, would come, you know, decades before anyone's predictions because of the exponential acceleration of technology. It's something we as humans can't grasp. Our own biological evolution is so painfully slow, right? But technology is like this. And we hit an inflection point, everything changes. So I think the future of the written word in particular is not in danger. Many people think it is. I use ChatGPT to do menial written tasks. Like the other day, I was having to write a listing to advertise my parents' home that they're selling in real estate. I'm like, I don't want to spend the time writing that. I just punched in, you know, the key facts of it and gave it some descriptors and it went and wrote it and I tweaked a couple of words. That's a wonderful tool. It's an amazing tool. Will it write great novels? No. Will people try to sell novels who are hacks? Yes. Yeah. And they're already doing it. You know, they're people that aren't interested in the art form will always take that shortest means to try and, you know, make a buck. But I don't think real writing is in danger. I think AI gives us this extension. And one of the ways that I'm an optimist, I think, ultimately, when I think about technology, even, you know, for all the dangers it represents, it is an equalizer, a leveler for society. What AI can do for people that don't have access to, you know, getting a computer science degree is, you know, it's been said that the new programming language is English because you can go into Copilot and you can say, can you build me an application that accepts email addresses and asks these four questions and can, you know, rather than have to go find a programmer and have money to do that, if you're a nonprofit or you're just someone trying to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, you can spend $10 or $20 a month for ChatGPT, and you have access to be able to author applications to solve real problems that you might have. And that is amazing. And I think that the same thing happened with the internet in terms of leveling the playing field for distribution and communication that was previously owned just by an elite group of people who are the gatekeepers of, you know, what was determined to be good in terms of books, movies, music. So not without its downsides, and we all know what those downsides are. We talk about them ad nauseum.
You've raised two kids and recently welcomed the joys of parenthood again. They must feel incredibly lucky to have you as their dad, especially with your deep appreciation for storytelling, literature, music, and the arts in general. So in a time when traditional reading often competes with apps and games on tablets, how have you practiced reading with your kids? What role do you see books playing in their lives amidst all the tech progress?
Yeah, I have a 27-year-old, 23-year-old, and now a 5-year-old. The 5-year-old is not my natural born child, but I've adopted her. With my own kids, I read all the time to them when they were little, you know, as early as, you know, a year old, putting them to bed. I would either tell them stories or read to them. Not because I had some intellectual idea about it, but it just felt like a natural thing to do. And I'm grateful that I did, because that served my older kids very well. They're both very gifted with language. They can express themselves very well. My daughter Ash is a tremendous writer. She's just really astonishes me when I read anything that she writes. She writes a lot of poetry, but it's just an extremely insightful and incisive writer. And it's exciting to see. And I think that that comes from reading. I don't know that our brains can develop in the same way without that experience of reading words on a page and having that magic happen inside of your head that develops that connection between the written word and unlocks your imagination.
You've shared that you have a 23-year-old and a 27-year-old. So now, reflecting on your own journey, if you were to go back in time to when you were 23, what wisdom or insights from your experience since then would you like to pass on to your younger self?
I think that what I would say is going to be probably contrary to what you might expect. Most people think, do what you love. You know, just pursue what you love to do. I think that's important, but I think that's not realistic in the world that we live in. Unless you have, you know, a trust fund or some other means of financially supporting yourself and what you want to do. I think I would have, my mother was very supportive of me, and she instilled in me this need to be creative and artistic, and praised me a lot and encouraged me to do whatever I wanted to do. But I think to me that set up a lot of disappointment, right? Or an expectation that I had to be something more. So I think what I would tell my 16-year-old self is, yes, you can be a musician, you know, you can be a writer, you could be an actor, you could do any of those things. But the way that you actually pay the bills, the way that you take care of yourself, is highly likely that's not going to be the way that you'll be able to do it. So understand that that's, the world is not persecuting you for that. That is just the nature of the world, and it always has been. Most artists don't survive, you know, financially. And the ones that we do, if you think of, you know, the great painting masters, their works, they lived in poverty, and their works now sell for, you know, millions of dollars, billions of dollars. But the truth is, art is an ephemeral thing. So do it for the joy of doing it and for your own need, but to try and expect the world to reflect to you the value of it is a fool's errand. It truly is. So I think that's, again, maybe contrary to what you might expect, but that's the definition that I've tried to give both of my grown kids. I taught a lot in my younger years when I was transitioning into trying to make a real living for my family. I taught guitar lessons and songwriting in my early 20s, teaching people. A lot of guys my age would come in and had spent a lifetime sort of being numb by a corporate life. And they had this hunger to tap into something else that they had when they were 15 or 16, and they maybe played in a little garage band and had just given it all up. So most of it was permission for me just to say, we're going to write a song today. I've never written a song before. Well, we're going to write a song today. You know how to write a song. You've heard songs before. So I think that's the place for it. Anyone can write a novel. Anyone can write a short story. Anyone can write a play. Anyone can pick up a guitar and learn how to sing a song. Well, you know, millions of people pack stadiums to see you? No. Highly likely that that won't happen, right? And if that's the reason you're doing it, then you're missing the point. So I think the hybrid life and the one that I've tried to navigate is I never stopped making art, even after I had a child very young and another one and raised them and did all the sacrifices that I had to financially provide for them. I still performed. I recorded, you know, 5 albums and released them. I started writing a novel. I never stopped. I never gave it up. Not because I thought that I was going to, you know, follow in the footsteps of John Mayer, who I played with back in the early days and watched him rocket to success, but because it was a foothold to remember who I really am. Because when you get in the corporate universe, someone else is telling you every single day, you know, what your value is. And your value is so far sometimes away from who you really are. So that's how I could remember, yeah, this is who Ben Wakeman is. This is what he really cares about. So that to me is the best I could do in terms of a hybrid life.
Very inspiring. Very, very inspiring to hear you, how you create art. And now flipping that on its head, what do you like to do in your downtime? What does your self-care look like?
I think that there's a huge value in doing nothing sometimes. Sitting quietly, you know, taking a walk. That's really where the restorative thing happens inside of us, is having that peace. And nature is a huge part of that for me. And I get out every single day, walk around 5 miles through the park. But there's never enough of that, I think. There's never enough of that time, because everything else is always just crushing in around us.
So as we near the end of our conversation, do you have any particular thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Keep enough free time to make art that is undeniable, to tell stories that people want to hear, they need to hear.
Thank you, Ben, for sharing your life story of joy and hope with us today. It's been truly enlightening and inspiring.
Thank you, Marty.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope you found this conversation as engaging as I have. Don't forget to visit our show notes for links to Ben's work and other material mentioned today. And join us next time on Leading with Joy for season 3 of more thought-provoking discussions. And until then, wishing you lots of joy in your journey.